We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that you really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is David Hunter. He's a contrarian macro strategist with 48 years experience, and he also writes a quarterly letter by subscription. Thanks for joining me today again, David.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, we're almost there, and it's a real marker to be able to kind of get to speak with you every quarter and going into the end of the year here. I want to maybe start by getting your thoughts. You know, coming into the end of 2021, has there been anything that surprised you about this year in the markets and their reactions that we saw?
Certainly timing. I mean, I thought we could see things happen, speed up a little faster. I had coming into 2021 said we could see the top in the market by mid-year, and we're obviously not there yet. I've raised targets this year along the way. So the resiliency has been maybe a little surprising. Not that much to me, because I have said all along that the melt up, when it comes, can go, you know, higher than I expect, because certainly once you're in that parabolic, you just don't know. So it's not really surprising how where we are in the market. It's more that it's kind of taken longer. And some of that is the I think the supply chain has stretched things out. It slowed some things down in the summer, and that just gave us more breathing room. So now it looks like you're getting towards that later stretch where you might be, you know, 3 or 4 months away rather than 6 or 8 months away. So, but yeah, that was a little surprising, and certainly the length of time we've stayed in consolidation in the metals has been a real surprise to me and probably to everybody. But I think that's something I learned over my nearly five decades of doing this, is markets are in charge, not you. You can kind of assume things, but sometimes they just take longer than you expect.
Absolutely. And you know, in that lens, David, considering the traditional relationship where gold, we think, usually responds to inflation, Is that the reason that you think we haven't seen it respond the way we would expect it to?
No, I really would have expected it sooner. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think some of this, you hear a lot of people blaming it on, manipulation by the central banks, manipulation by the government. I don't believe that at all. But what I do think is happening is I think the algos have a very simplistic model of what gold, what the metals are tied to, and that is interest rates. So when rates go up, the algos sell. And, mm-hmm. As we've said many times, or at least I have, it's really real rates. And frankly, it's not so much rates as it is inflation. So real rates are obviously nominal rates, less inflation. But really, when you back it all out, it's truly inflation that drives gold and silver. So I would have expected it by now. I think algos, I'm not particularly impressed with their models or how they go about things, but they're pretty dogmatic about it. And so until we get out of that kind of mode, and that, I've seen it without algos, I've seen it through many cycles, that people get locked into one equation. And then all of a sudden that equation changes, everybody forgets about it. But at least for now, the algos have kind of been the ones, I think, holding things down. And if you want to talk about manipulation, there's always manipulation in markets in terms of, traders saying, hey, well, let's give it this look and then we can take advantage of that. So, there's active market manipulation, legal manipulation, really, but in terms of manipulation by central banks, I frankly just don't think the central banks care about gold right now.
Yeah, it's always, important to make that distinction of what type of manipulation we're talking about, whether it's that longer term central bank based manipulation that we're thinking about, or if it's that short-term spoofing type of manipulation, which has been proven, and there have been banks, you know, charged with that, right?
Yeah, and that's not even what I was talking about, because spoofing obviously is illegal, so that's a different story. But there's also trading desks saying, "Hey, we want to get a position and build a position in gold or silver, mm-hmm. you know, but we can play around with a little bit and help the market go down some before we step in and get a better price." So there, you know, traders can play games and give it a look and get investors to react to that. That's legal. I mean, that's gone on forever. Mm-hmm. But spoofing is illegal. But it's only, you know, it's really, you know, skimming for pennies. And yet people hear the word manipulation and they go, "See, I told you, you know, the banks are manipulating it." So, mm-hmm.
So David, considering, you know, the long-term experience that you have, what have been some of the relationships that gold has played, you know, going up with, as you said, real rates or, you know, inflationary expectations? How has that changed over the years to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really focused on that. I mean, I believe it is an inflation-driven market. I also think it is very much a dollar-driven market, you know, or currency-driven market. So in whatever currency you're investing, if the currency is going down, you know, it should appreciate. So I still am a very big bear on the dollar here, and I think that will be a driving element. Other than that, I mean, obviously the big time in gold early on was going back to the 70s and early 80s, and that was inflation driven, no question about it. The period between 2001 and 2011 was a great run, and you know, some of that was I don't know, actually, when you think about it, because it wasn't an inflation period, it was a disinflation period. I guess it was probably, and that's probably where the rate tie-in came. People kind of determined that that was what drove it then. I just view it as, if we think the last year has been a long consolidation, from 1980 to 2000, basically 99, and then a double bottom in 2001, you know, you basically had a pretty long consolidation there, and we broke out of that. And what really drove the metals, in my opinion, is technically it broke out and then, you know, it kind of took on you know, traders love that. When they see the momentum, they just chase momentum and it keeps going. So, you know, that's really what we have to wait for here, too, is once it finally gets out of this consolidation, I think you will see a lot of people come back to it.
So David, considering, you know, since the last time we saw that spike that we were just talking about in gold, and, you know, thinking about momentum trades, as you mentioned, we saw Bitcoin and other cryptos hit all-time highs this year. Do you think that this has taken a great amount of capital flow away from the metals?
No, I mean, certainly there's probably gold investors that are moving over there, but, you know, I just think it's more, most people, most investors, most traders want momentum. And when a group is, a market is going against you, or going, you know, either in a flat or down type of move, I think you just generally see people move away from it. And, you know, all the rhetoric that surrounds gold and silver now that's bearish, and all the rhetoric that surrounded Bitcoin when it was, you know, straight up and up and up and up, you know, you hear all the predictions. If you really step back and look at what the predictions are, they're basically extrapolating the past to the future, right? I mean, that's really what it is. And those same people with no conscience, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but with no thought of what they said before, will do a complete reverse, you know, on that position or on that view when the momentum goes the other way. It may take them a little while to pick up the momentum. But so, you know, again, what am I talking about? I'm talking about psychology. More mm-hmm. than anything else, it's psychology that drives these markets. So, you know, while you're in this consolidation, yeah, there's a lot of negative talk out there. A lot of people give you ever lower targets, et cetera. You know, it's really just psychology speaking.
So, you know, we're speaking here on the morning of Tuesday, December 14th. And of course, we saw the PPI print this morning of 9.6%. So, David, I'd like to kind of go back and get your expectations for the inflationary environment going forward here.
Yeah, I've had probably one of the higher forecasts in terms of inflation all through this year. And I basically, my forecast of a bust is tied to the fact that ultimately, I think the Fed's going to have to, and obviously everybody's joined me now, but at the time I was saying it, you know, a year ago or more, I said ultimately what will end the cycle will be inflation and the Fed having to respond to that inflation by tightening. And where I think my 48 years comes in handy is that I was there in the, you know, the 79, 80, 81 period. And what I think people are going to be surprised at is how hard it is to put that inflation genie back in the bottle. So it's not, you know, people kind of talk in terms of, oh yeah, the Fed tightens, then they ease as soon as they see things going the other way. It doesn't work that way. They're going to be caught between a rock and a hard place where the markets are going down, but inflation isn't. And they've got to keep on trying to get that inflation down and kind of let the market go where it may. So it won't be an easy time for Jay Powell. And I think that time is coming up fairly soon, probably second quarter, where they're going to have to begin tightening. But who knows? I mean, one thing we are seeing is, you know, and I keep pushing back against the taper and saying taper is still easing. You know, taper is just easing less. So people say, well, is this what you were looking for? Is this, you know, what's going to turn the market? I said, no, this is still easing. And even in the early stages of tightening, markets can still go up and typically do still go up. So you know, you can't jump it too soon. But I do think that we're seeing a flattening of the yield curve. So there is tightening going on. You know, the market's doing it, not the Fed. And that may be, you know, some of the reason for the pullback this week is people are starting to see that, and maybe a little bit of the weakness today in the metals. But ultimately, I think there's still room. I continue to say there's a melt up coming in the market, and you know I've kind of pushed my expectation for the bust out to the second half of next year.
So, David, you mentioned that the Fed is going to have to, you know, really try to fight inflation here. What tools do they really have to be able to make that happen? Do you see them as, you know, trapped in this situation?
Not at all. No, I mean, it's basically pulling money out of the system. QT is the primary one. The secondary one is what we're seeing the market do now, which is, you know, you could even go to an inverse interest rate situation here. And it's not so much, you know, I don't see obviously the Fed raising Fed fund rates up to a level that they'll be higher than the 10-year. That's not going to happen. But as you're seeing, you know, twos to tens are flattening. You know, at some point in the next 3, 4, 5 months, that's going to probably be a negative yield curve. That tends to really turn things around, slow things down, certainly will hit the markets. So it's both, you know, the yield curve management and frankly, as I've said for a while, you know, the bond market really takes care of that. Everybody wants to know where the Fed's going to do things. The Fed will be reacting to the bond market more than leading it. And their big role is going to be pulling money out of the system. I think if in fact CPI, PPI, and you know the deflator index continue to move up, they're going to feel more and more pressure to say we got to pull money off the table here. We've got to get it out of there because it's just, you know. And frankly, it's not just inflation. If you go back to the early 80s, and typically any of our economic ends are, you know, tops of an economic cycle, it's really an overheating economy. That is what they're responding to. Inflation's kind of the end result of what overheating does, but it's the fact that the economy is getting heated up so much that they say we got to cool this thing down. And you know, frankly, I've said this for a couple of years. in this cycle, I think it's going to be more about QT than it is interest rates.
So considering all of the lockdowns and the economic damage that has been done over the last 2 years, is the Fed still responding to an economy that is overheated?
Well, they are, in terms of, they're beginning to respond in terms of I think Paul's comments a couple of weeks ago, when he acknowledged that this isn't just supply shortages, you know, this isn't just supply chain issues, that this is real, you know, real, and it's probably not transitory. I think along with that was an acknowledgement that, hey, we went from a 2.2%, he didn't say this, but from a 2.2% third quarter to one that now, at least the Atlanta Fed is estimating, is 9.7% for the fourth quarter. And it looks like it's, you know, maybe picking up steam from there. So really, as that supply chain situation starts to heal a bit, particularly in housing and in autos, you've got, you know, obviously, you know, autos, it's chips. You've got the ability for some catch-up demand, you know, where there's people who couldn't buy a car because the inventory was so low. There was people who, home builders that weren't building houses because lumber was so high. Now you're seeing some of the catch-up in that. And I think that carries into the first quarter. I think the Fed recognizes all of that and is really worried about it in terms of, how much sustainability does that have? And how much does that push inflation into a, you know, something that doesn't stop? Mm-hmm.
So, David, how does oil fit into the picture to feed or cool these inflationary pressures as well?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think the interesting dynamic here is that, and I was, I think, pretty alone at $85 on oil and saying, I think we've seen the peak of the cycle, oil price wise. And I got beat up pretty bad on Twitter. People thought I was crazy and, you know, it didn't make any sense. We were going to $100, et cetera. But I think supply is beginning to come out. And I think so some of that run up to 85 was somewhat artificial in that everybody held back supply, not just OPEC, but our companies here. And I think so that was part of my thinking, was that we were going to see supply come out and that, you know, It's a discounting the future, and basically, you know, all the good news was in oil. So I think now we're in a range between 60 and 75, and probably going to see a drop from there at some point in the next several months. That argues that you have one thing at least that has been a big driver of inflation that's going to be actually softening that inflation or pulling it back down somewhat. So I don't know how that will all work together, because I have a forecast of copper going to $6 here in the next 6 months. So you're going to have cross currents where you have most of the commodities going up further and up sharply in some cases, and oil going the other way. But gasoline and oil obviously have a real impact on consumers. So I think you could have kind of an interesting period here where I'm not sure how inflation expectations shake out with that dynamic, but I do think oil has had its day and is, you know, my forecast for next year's bust is that oil will fall into the 20s. So I do think there's a lot lower oil coming, but not in the next few months. The next few months, it's probably somewhere in the mid to high 50s up to 75. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned copper there, David, and you and I have spoken before about this, you know, this possible commodities super cycle. So is copper, you know, one of the standouts to you in that cycle coming, simply because of the transition to the you know, the green future? Or is it just commodities in general that are going to really do well because of the, you know, the industrial recovery that you have told us about?
Yeah, I think the prospects for copper are very exciting. So it's kind of both. I do think, by the way, I don't think we're in that commodity super cycle yet. This is kind of the precursor to it. But as I say, there's a global bust coming between now and the super cycle. And I, you know, equate it to standing on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, looking across the north rim and thinking you can walk straight across when in fact there's this huge canyon in between. You know, you can look at commodities now and probably for the next few months and think, oh, this is the beginning of the super cycle. But then you have what I'm calling a global bust that I think is the worst downturn in the post-World War II era, standing between here and there. So I think the super cycle starts after the bust, probably late 2023, and carries through to the end of the decade. And it will surpass the highs of commodity prices this cycle by a long shot. I mean, some will double, triple, quadruple, et cetera. So there's a huge super cycle coming, but this is not it yet. It's kind of the precursor to it. And I do think it will cover commodities across the board. Ag commodities will be very high in the next decade. I think oil goes to $400 a barrel. You know, gold and silver can go to $400, gold to 10 or 20,000, who knows. And, you know, zinc and iron ore, et cetera, will go through the roof, steel. So I think we will have that super cycle, but I just caution people, it's not a straight line from here. And in terms of copper itself, you know, I say, you know, we're in the low fours now. I think it can go to $6 in the next 6 months. In the bust, it could go back to $2 or even lower. And then next cycle, you know, pick a number. I don't know whether 20, 30, 40, you know, copper's going to go straight up. So copper will get the benefit of certainly, you know, EV and you know, all of that. It will have demand in the industrial sector, because I think the next recovery is going to be industrial. And we've always known copper to be what we call Dr. Copper, because it, as we say, has a PhD in economics. It's probably the most sensitive to the economy and certainly sensitive to a industrial recovery as opposed to a consumer-led recovery. We've for 40 years had consumer-led recoveries. This next one, I think, is going to be more like the 70s, where 1970s, where it's very industrial driven, and certainly part of that industrial recovery will be, you know, the whole electric vehicle area and batteries, et cetera. So copper is going to certainly see demand through the roof.
So, David, when we hear you, you know, give us these predictions of $400 silver and $10,000 plus gold, is this due to the fact that the US dollar is going to be, you know, so devalued in that environment?
It's certainly that'll be part of it, but It's really going to be global demand. You know, what we really are looking at is if you really look back to even before 2020, but if you look back to March 2020 and how central banks around the world responded to the pandemic. I mean, you know, I think we skirt over the fact that we went from back in 2008, we had $875 billion dollars in a Fed balance sheet. And today we have $9 trillion. And most of that $9 trillion, certainly, you know, five of it is since March 2020. And then you look around the world and certainly, you know, similar things, maybe not as big as the Fed, but certainly every central bank pushed money out the door in big ways. Some of that's impacting right now, but it's going to impact for years to come. And then, as I say, if we get this global bust that I'm talking about, there's only one way they can respond to. And by the way, that global bust can be accompanied by what I think could be the worst global financial crisis in history, meaning banks free falling, you know, failures everywhere. The only thing they can do in a timely fashion is print money, shove money out the door as fast as they can, and, you know, declare moratoriums and all kinds of things. You're going to see, if we think, you know, the last $5 trillion came fast, then the next, and this is just the Fed, the next 10 or 15 or 20 trillion is going to come faster. Mm-hmm. And then with a lag, I think that just explodes. And again, we're going to see proportionally similar around the world, including People's Bank of China, et cetera. Every central bank's going to have to be flooding the system with money. Initially, it's doing it into a vacuum of a free-falling financial system and a you know a bust. But with a lag, that money starts really building up demand. And the reason I think we get an industrial recovery, first, the bust is going to hit consumers pretty hard, so they're going to be digging out. But secondly, accompanying that money, because that money doesn't do anything without help, will be massive fiscal spending, massive fiscal stimulus. And most of what is that fiscal stimulus going to look like? An awful lot of it is going to be infrastructure. So whatever we've done in infrastructure now, they'll just make it even bigger. You know, they'll buy a lot. And, you know, our whole electric grid needs, you know, transformation, et cetera. Our rail system, our airports, whatever they've done now, and I'm not saying this is good for the long-term future, but it's, I think it's inevitable. And so I think all of that is going to just, you know, have an awful lot of money going, an awful lot of money chasing few goods. And what does that mean? That means inflation, and inflation, particularly in commodities.
So, David, between now and then, do you see the demand for the U.S. dollar continuing to be high, regardless of the devaluation that we have seen thus far?
Yeah, I'll answer it this way. My forecast is that we're going to see, and I'm probably the bear on the street, and you know, people are skeptical of this call, but I think over the next 6 months, we could see the dollar fall to 85 from, you know, the current 96 level, you know, got up to 97. I think it's beginning to weaken. I think you'll see 85, and I think there's a real chance you could see 80. And, you know, a lot of that is inflation and you know, fears of what that's creating. And but in the bust, I expect the dollar to get the flight to safety trade it always gets in a crisis. Mm-hmm. And so I would expect, whether it's from 80 or 85, we could see the dollar back to 120, maybe 130 or 40. I don't know. I'd say 120 is reasonable. And then that should top off the dollar for, if not forever, certainly for a long time. And I think from there, we begin a long slide through the rest of the decade that'll take it ultimately down below 50. So in answer to your earlier question, that certainly will be a piece of commodity price inflation. And, you know, if the dollar goes from 120 to 50, you can bet that that's inflationary. Mm-hmm.
So talking about, you know, different currencies and you mentioned China in there as well. If they introduced, let's say, a gold-backed central bank digital currency, does this create a scenario where that currency is more desirable to be used in trade for other countries?
My whole skepticism about the reset and you know, cryptocurrencies being a part of a reset is it just doesn't fit the timing at this point, because what are we going to need more than, why is crypto, and this isn't exactly what you're talking, but why is crypto so popular? It's popular, and who is it most popular with? It's most popular with those that buy into the Austrian school, right? And who really believe that the central banks are evil, and you know, Federal Reserve is the reason we're in this mess, and we need something outside their control because they don't know how to manage money, et cetera, right? The problem is, if we get this global bust that I think is inevitable, there's only, as I said before, there's only one tool. If we don't use that tool, let's say the Fed got religion and said, no, we're not doing it this time. We did it. You know, we know the mistakes we made before. We're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. We'll let the system cleanse itself. We'd all be living in caves. This thing would collapse right unto itself. You know, you would see a total collapse of the global financial system. Mm-hmm. The only thing that saves it or postpones a collapse is massive money. So you know, you can't put a gold-backed currency into the system to deal with a problem that's built over the last 50 years at the time when, you know, it would be the worst time to implement discipline if your goal is to save the system. Mm-hmm. If your goal is to start all over from whatever mess we're in, you know, from whatever depths of despair we go into, that's a different story. But I don't think in reality any government or any central bank would stand by, even if they started with that thought, would stand by watching 80% of the people basically have going starving, no food, no, you know, nothing in the economy working, 80% unemployment rate. That's what you'd have if you just let the system collapse onto itself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is crypto? It's some sort of discipline because you're not expanding it all the time, right? This is going to call for massive expansion. And again, I'm not endorsing it. I'm saying it's inevitable that, you know, it's not realistic to think that a government would self-destruct like that. Mm-hmm.
So, David, I'd like to go back to your calls here. You've said that once we see these intermediate lows, and of course we're seeing some of that today, and I'd like to kind of get to the thought about paying attention to the news every day. We'll get to that a little bit later, but you see this melt-up scenario where we could see the S&P soar to 5,300 and the NASDAQ to 18,000. So do you see this being correlated with another round of stimulus or reversal on Fed policy once we see a little bit of a slide here?
I don't think so, because I think it'd be expecting too much for the Fed to now just begin to speed up taper. And a month later say, oh, you know, whoops, we goofed. We're going to start easing again. So I don't think that's part of the scenario. I really think it's driven. And by the way, I do, you know, as you see on Twitter, I've called for the NASDAQ to fall to 14,500 to 15,000 with 14,500 likely. And the S&P probably holding 4,500, but it could, in if things really got unwound, get down as low as 4,300. I think right now what I'd say is likely 4,500, which is pretty much the trend line from 2020. So from there, and I think that happens in the next week.
That's the intermediate low that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's just a correction of this. You know, we had, it's really a continuation of the correction that started early this month. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a week where, you know, last week where it jumped right out of that and everybody said, oh, we're off to the races. Here's your melt up. And I said, I don't think so. And I think this is just a, you know, retest in the case of the S&P, probably a successful retest of the lows of 2 weeks ago. And in the NASDAQ, maybe a failed retest, but, you know, not a huge fail. And then I think the melt up gets started, probably a year end rally, you know, just before Christmas through the end of the year. And I think January is a strong, strong month. And, you know, looking at cross markets and looking at groups, et cetera, I think if anything, my targets are too low. So 5,300 on the S&P, 18,000 on the NASDAQ. I think it's going to be a rip roaring final leg to a 39-year secular bull market driven by, more than anything, the strength in the economy and the strength in commodities, et cetera. So I think, you know, we're at highest profit margins ever. You know, companies are really, as much as we're talking about inflation eating into profits, et cetera, not yet. The companies have done a marvelous job of keeping margins very high. You know, keeping costs under control where they can, et cetera. You're getting, you know, still lots of share buybacks. So I think the first quarter is going to be a gangbusters earnings quarter, a gangbusters GDP quarter. And I think that's what drives things. And at the same time, yes, rates are moving up, But I don't think they're going to be moving up so fast that they shut that off.
David, when you say that we have, you know, some of the highest profit margins ever, how do you take into account the zombie companies or these companies like Netflix that don't actually make a profit? Is that part of what you're talking about?
Well, no, I mean, I don't go micro, so I can't talk about individual companies and mm-hmm. what they look like. But in general, corporate profit margins are, you know, on a large scale are at the highest levels ever. You're always going to have zombie companies and in this cycle, probably more than ever because of the leverage in the system. Mm-hmm. Cash flow is a big part. So, you know, for those analytics companies, they could answer this much better than me in terms of, you know, whether it's earnings or whether it's cash flow, there's, you know, companies doing very well. Now, I acknowledge, in fact, it's been part of my story for a long time. The pandemic makes this a really, and this recovery is a really different recovery, meaning the recovery from March of 2020. There's still huge imbalances in areas of our economy and in areas of you know, in the haves versus the have-nots. You know, that's part of the story of why we're going to have a bust. You can statistically look and say, wow, we're in great times. And, you know, been people of late, including the president, saying, you know, we're in a great economy. And yet there's a lot of people left out of this and a lot of companies and industries and things left out. So I don't mean to say this is, you know, everything's all wonderful. All I'm saying is that I think from a statistical and earnings standpoint, we're in that place where I think the momentum is going to just pick up speed and you're going to see the market follow that. The other side of the coin, though, is, which is why I'm a bit unique out there, is that I probably have the most bullish forecast on the next, you know, 3 or 4 months in the market and the economy, but also probably the most bearish forecast for the next year. You know, with that global bust being something, I mean, to say something is the worst financial crisis in history means it's going to be bigger than 2008-9, bigger than 29 in some respects, just because we're so big now. And it's global. It's not, I don't even think our banks in the US are the ones that are at risk, particularly. It's up your way. You know, your banks are in much worse shape than they were going into 2008. Australia, Europe is certainly in really bad shape banking wise. So, and Asia. So I think it's a, you know, it's a global story. I focus obviously on the US in terms of markets, but we're at extreme imbalances in lots of ways.
So once we get this global bust, as you call it, David, is it going to be a you know, long drawn out affair, or is it going to be a, you know, relatively shorter, dramatic crash that we see all these banks fail and it's just a real domino effect that lasts maybe a couple of months before we see the bottom?
Yeah, I've used the term global deflationary bust for many years as what I thought this cycle would end in because of leverage in the system. And so I kind of coined the term. You know, bust is obviously a term that's been out there forever, but I use it specifically to define an economic downturn that is worse than a typical recession, worse than in some ways than the Great Recession, but not long and drawn out like a depression. So in some ways, does the damage of a depression or feels like a depression, but is not like the Great Depression lasting many years. So I think it'll be contained within a year. And actually, because of the leverage, it speeds everything up. It almost says that, you know, both the unwind and the reaction to the unwind have to happen immediately or fast, just because it is so leveraged. Mm-hmm. So I think almost because of that, you can expect that, let's say it starts second half of this year, of next year. You can expect it probably is pretty much over by the middle of 2023. And that we begin, not that it'll feel like it, but we may begin a recovery by the second half of 2023.
So, David, considering the long-term perspective that your experience affords you, do you not worry about the day-to-day noise that we often see? And are there any indicators that you watch closely to confirm your read on the markets here?
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest friction points out there is, you know, I've got 125,000 followers on Twitter, and you know, most of them are silent. Probably the most vocal ones, in addition to the trolls, are trader types. People that have, and you know, some experienced traders and some just retail people that think that's how you invest. And they react to day-to-day news that I could care less about. I just keep saying it's a discounting, markets are a discounting mechanism. That means they're discounting things months in advance. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't influence based on like today's news on PPI, et cetera. Of course there is. But in terms of the trends, in terms of the longer term forecast, you know, the day to day, I tell people turn off your screens and ignore it. There's way too much noise. And that's what I call it is noise. I use the term ignore the noise because I think it's counterproductive to good investing. And so, you know, there's always a surprise that can come in and really turn things around and change things. But for the most part, my forecasts are, you know, not set in stone, but they're, you know, they're based on longer term trends, and, you know, the day-to-day ups and downs really don't impact them at all.
When you say good investing at this point, David, where do you see good investments? Where do those areas lie, and do those areas change as soon as we get into that second quarter of next year?
Yeah, I got to be really careful because I can't provide any advice and direction. So I don't know if I can answer that. But what I will say is I do expect that the sectors that will perform in the melt-up, the groups that will perform, will include semiconductors, will include the FANGs, will include the small cap stocks. So the Russell, I have a target of 2,900 on, and there's a lot of bears out there because it, you know, broke out and came right back in hard. But I like the small cap as in terms of outperforming. I think the autos will do quite well. I think the home builders will continue to do well. I think industrials will do well. I think materials will do very well. I think airlines will do very well. And financials will do well. When you look at that list, that's a broad list. I keep hearing people talk about, oh, this market's just being propped up by a handful of big cap growth stocks, you know, the FANGs, you know, Apple and Amazon and Netflix, et cetera. And I go, no, it isn't. If you look, yes, we've had a lot of stocks in consolidation for much of this year, a lot of groups, but they're not breaking down. They're just, you know, they're consolidating the runs of 2020 and they're poised for big runs again. And so I think it's going to be a broad, relatively broad rally. There'll be, you know, I'm bearish on bonds. So I think utilities are going to lag. I think staples will lag, even though they're holding up right now versus a market that's down. But so there'll be groups that won't participate as always. But I really think you're going to have, I think it's going to be more focused on cyclicals and those that have pricing power. So, you know, the industrials and the materials, I think, are going to do exceptionally well. But I would not say that that means the FANGs aren't going to do well, because I don't think rates are going to move up fast enough to shut down the phenomenal growth that some of those companies have. And I also think, again, this is controversial, I also think, you know, the Cathie Wood's ARK ETF is likely to do quite well. So it's been massacred in the last several months, but I think it doesn't mean it's going to go on to new highs, because I don't know that. That would take a 70% move from here. But it could move up 50%. Mm-hmm. And that'd be a heck of a performance. So, I'm not saying it can't go to new heights. I'm just saying that's a big run if it does do that. But my point is that I think we're going to have an awful lot of things working. And on the other hand, I think it's important for people to understand this is the last hurrah. This isn't the beginning of something big, because as this, if I'm right about a melt-up, the ebullience that you're going to see among investors, both professional and retail alike, is going to be unlike anything we've seen in the last decade. You know, you're going to see an awful lot of people saying, oh, this thing has legs. This thing, you know, for whatever reason, you know, whatever dynamics are out there, I think we're going to not hear all this talk about Fed tightening. I think people are going to be focused on there's room for this thing to run for a long time. And my point in that is don't get caught up in that, because that's the normal psychology taking you to max bullishness at the top.
Of course, that's something to watch out for, that psychology of chasing that momentum, right, David?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that you'll see it build as you go through, I think, the first quarter. Mm-hmm. I can't pretend to know. I'm always early. I expected the top last this year. It could stretch further. I'm not saying it's going to necessarily top out first quarter. But if you see a parabolic here where it really gets going, those things generally burn out pretty fast. You know, it doesn't mean you have months and months to run. It probably, if this thing goes vertical, it probably tells you you're within the last month or two of the top. Mm-hmm.
David, you've said a couple times here that the Fed is really behind the curve. Of course, they're always reacting to, you know, in some ways, old indicators, right? So I've heard you say that you see Biden reappointing Jerome Powell as Fed chair being a good move. I want to get kind of your thinking on that. Is that because of the other alternatives were more dovish?
Yeah, certainly that's a big part of it. I think Lyle Brainard would have been, I don't want to say a disaster, because it is a consensus group, and you know the chair has power, but there's also a committee around them, but she's certainly very sympathetic to MMT and things like that, and I just think, you know, if the Fed loses all discipline, we're in trouble. So I'm glad Biden reappointed Powell. I'm in a funny spot, because I tell people a lot, I'm not endorsing, I'm just telling you what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the same thing with Powell. I think he, for the job he was handed, I was very critical of him in his first year as a Fed chairman. He was, you know, some of his comments were hurting the markets and hurting, you know, were counterproductive to just do your job. You know, your talk is what's, you know, messing things up. He got religion. He learned fast. And I would say March 2020, I wouldn't wish that job on anybody in March of 2020. And if his job was to stabilize things and get things turned back in the right direction, he did that in a big way, and he did it fast. Mm-hmm. And I think he deserves a lot more credit than he gets for that. And the way he has handled the meeting since then and the conferences that come out afterwards, I think he's done a very, very masterful job. And he gets lots of criticism from all those people that think the Fed's just, you know, just holding up the markets and all they care about is probably. No, he's looking at an economy that has a lot of imbalances, and he has to try to provide it the liquidity to make sure it doesn't go the other way. I give him a lot of credit for that. On the other hand, in the end, I think this all ends in a collapse. So, you know, am I cheering on? You know, I think anybody in that role would be forced to, you know, like I said, if you want to do what the Austrians want them to do, you know, one way or the other, and get discipline, you just have the collapse sooner. Mm-hmm. So all they're doing probably is stretching it out, but at least in stretching it out, you have some hope that new technologies and lots of other things come along and we can solve some of our problems that way or whatever. But frankly, you know, just speaking of the US, but you could speak of Canada, you could speak of Australia, you could speak of, you know, China, certainly you could speak of Europe. You know, this is a disaster waiting to happen. You know, we are borrowing from our future in such a way that it's impossible to ever think that equation can be solved. And, you know, ultimately, if I'm right that we go from bust to a hyperinflationary cycle by the end of this decade, you can't have the debt we have today and have high double-digit interest rates and solve that equation. You can't. Mm-hmm. It ends in collapse, in my opinion. So, you know, it's kind of a long way of saying, I think Powell, for what he's being asked to do right now, is doing a very good job. Is that in the end going to lead to something positive? No. Mm-hmm. You know, but I don't think it's his fault. I think you can lay the blame of this on every administration going back, and not just the U.S., but you know, you can lay the blame on all of us, basically, because we borrowed from our futures to live for today. We, you know, I know in this country, revenue sharing, people think that's a positive thing. It's like, why should somebody on the East Coast borrow money from somebody in another state to build their sidewalks? That's how it works. You know, we can go to the government and get grants, get revenue sharing, and also, but basically, you know, why are we not living within our means? And, you know, it's a whole different philosophical discussion. But basically, that's been going on for decades and decades. And what has happened now is it's accelerated to such a level that it becomes inevitable that it can't be sustained.
Yeah, of course, we've made the point several times of the fact that there can't really be any political appetite to, you know, pull in the reins and live within our means and not continue the trend of printing and quantitative easing that we have seen, because that is, you know, exactly the opposite of, you know, the Fed's mandate, any way of getting reelected or anything positive for the economy or the system in general, right?
Yeah, it's not realistic. And when you think about it, you know, particularly all those people that want to criticize, if you were in their shoes and you saw the suffering that would have to be endured, mm-hmm. for the policies you're preaching, you wouldn't be able to withstand it. You know, no truly human being would say it's okay to watch, you know, 80% of the citizens, you know, live in squander and basically be dying from starvation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're going to have if you allow the system to just collapse onto itself. So I'm not an endorser of what we've done, but we should have taken our medicine 30, 40 years ago, not now. I mean, mm-hmm. now it's too late.
Excellent, David. You know, illuminating conversation as always, and I appreciate getting to speak with you again. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Yeah, I just want to talk about bonds for a second, because I do think, I came out on Twitter last week saying it looks to me like the utility average is ready to roll over and head for at least a 10%, maybe as much as a 12% correction. That's a big correction in utilities. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't see those move that much. So, and I'm not saying it's imminent, like the next day or two or three. And I'm also not saying it's going to happen in a couple weeks in terms of the whole move. But I think over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, that's what I see in that. And then what that's doing is confirming to me my call on bonds, which is that we're heading, I think we've seen our move in bonds. I called the rally back to 135.40 from 175 on the 10-year. I think we've had that move, and now I think we're going to begin. We're at 145.6 today is the last I saw. I think we're beginning to move to 2.5, which is where I see it going in the next several months, mm-hmm. next few months. And that, I think the utilities confirmed that move. So basically, you've got interest rates are going to be moving up here and moving up as a in reaction to inflation and a stronger economy, an economy that's really getting overheated. I just would say that that's, in spite of the fact that I'm so bullish on this last leg in the equities, it's going to be happening at the same time that bonds are getting hit. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting, I think, because this whole cycle has been about disinflation and ever lower interest rates. And now we're going to come into something that's more like what I lived through in the late 70s, early 80s, where you actually can see the stock market go up while rates are going up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting environment to pay attention to and to try to make sense of, right?
Yeah, I'd even say 2022 could be one for the ages in terms of, if I'm right about the timing, you can have, the biggest rally in history, this last leg, and then followed by the biggest unwind since 1929, 2930.
Excellent, David. Of course, we spoke a lot about your Twitter feed and where you make a lot of those calls. That's at David H. Contrarian. And you write the quarterly letter as well, right?
Yeah, it's actually at Dave H. Contrarian. Mm-hmm. Not David, but Dave H. Contrarian.
Okay.
I do have a quarterly letter. It's by subscription. There's a cost to it. So if people have any interest, just reach out to me. You can direct message me on Twitter and I'll provide details there.
Excellent, David. Thanks so much for your time today.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. You have a Merry Christmas.
You too.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.